My name is Michelle, and I'm a compulsive eater.
I'm Michelle.
And that's why I'm here today. I joined OA in 1985. I don't remember the month. And I got abstinent in 1987. Weight loss or gain? I maintained a 90-pound weight loss since 1990. And what brought me into OA in 1985 was I developed an ulcer. And I was, 38. And my mother at that time was dying of obesity-related diseases. I knew that. She weighed 250. At the time, I weighed 240. And I thought, oh, that's going to be me. And it started, because the first thing she got was an ulcer. Then she got high blood pressure. Then she got diabetes. Then she got a hiatal hernia. And then she got congestive heart failure. But they kept saying to her, if you lose weight, we could do something with this. But she never was able to. And my ulcer really scared me. I remember the panic. It was a Thursday that I found out, and by Saturday I was in an OA meeting. Because in those days, they would put OA in public service announcements in the newspaper. And so I knew there was an OA, because, you know, and I knew it was based on AA, you know. I hadn't seen it that often. I just knew there was one. So I went to the newspaper and looked it up, and I came to a meeting on Saturday in 1985, and except for when I'm out of town sometimes visiting my children, I've never left and never missed a meeting unless I was out of town. There may have been some gaps there when I moved or so forth. And the reason that's true is I was pretty desperate. Not only had my weight been bothering me, I was in pain all the time. My back hurt, my legs hurt, my feet hurt. I had been wearing orthopedic shoes since I hit 200, maybe even a little lower than that, for years, because my feet hurt so bad. But I'll start at the beginning. I was born in Queens, New York, to a woman who had five children by five different men and never married anyone. So it was a very unconventional setup, as you can imagine. I was born in 1946. You don't have to do the math, I'm 72. But my mother was born in 1925, and to have four or five children by the time you're 22, in those days, and never marry, and get thrown out of your family, and told to leave town, and which she did. She was from a small town in upstate New York, and they literally said, you can't stay here. So I'm just giving you the framework of the dysfunction. She was a single mother with these four children. She had a fifth one later. And when she came downstate, she went on welfare. So I was raised on welfare until the last man came into the picture and stayed. And what that meant was government food, which was not what you like, you know, when you're a child, government food. You know, the boxes of cheese that came in gray cardboard. And we went to a special place in those days. You went to a different place in the grocery store for that kind of food. And when you went through the line, it was very noticeable. You had the government food and somebody else had something else. The only thing I can say about my mother, God rest her soul, is she was very well-meaning. She never had an unkind word to say about anyone. But she was distant and worked all the time. I saw very little of her at all. She rarely said more to me than pass the salt. She said two significant things to me in my life, once when I got married and once when I was starting high school. I remember what she said when I got married, but not what she said when I went to high school. Otherwise, I didn't know her. I didn't know her middle name. I didn't know how many brothers and sisters she had. I knew where she came from. I knew the name of the town. But she was a very, very private, silent person. In one of the meetings I went to, they said, I was raised in the violence of silence. And that was us. That was us. Six people at the table, and not a word is spoken. I didn't realize that. You know, I knew it was painful, but I didn't realize just how unusual it was. The three things that I put down on my paper was, I'm an old timer. I've been around since 1985. I have a weight loss and I'm a trauma survivor. I was molested by both my half-brothers, my stepdad and a neighbor boy. And I don't know why, my sister was only 13 months younger than me and normal weight. And to hear her tell it, nothing ever happened to her. So I think I was just a vulnerable person from the beginning. And it just, the two messages I brought out of my childhood was, I was hungry. That sounds kind of funny, I was hungry all the time. And when I got into my teen years and could buy my own food, I thought I was making up for the fact that I was hungry as a child. And now I'm not so sure that we didn't have enough to eat, although we didn't have extra. But maybe I just couldn't get enough because I was already eating disordered. Because I was normal weight at 9, because we always just had adequate food. And then when the last man came into the picture when I was 10, between 10 and 12, I weighed 160 pounds. I just ballooned up because the food was coming into the house differently. The only reason I remember I weighed 160 pounds is because I got weighed in home ec. You know, in those days, you made dresses, and I will never forget it. She said my 160 pounds right out loud, size 18. And that was hard to get over until I'd been abstinent for quite some time, I can tell you that. I don't have any pictures, and I'll tell you why. I always cut myself out of pictures, even when I was a kid. All the pictures that my husband might take, or somebody might take of my husband and I and the kids, or whenever, I cut myself out of them when I got divorced. I did have two pictures left. When I came into OA, I looked for them and I found them. My handbag got stolen. I used to carry them in my handbag, and my handbag got stolen when I went to New York on a trip, so I don't even have them. So that's why I don't have any pictures to pass around. But I had the thunder thighs, and I had all my weight basically in the middle. I was like a barrel. So I'm just really grateful that
something's
wrong with it.
Yeah, it's the feedback's pretty bad.
Maybe I should move away.
That would help too, but...
Okay.
Excuse me.
I never dated in high school because I was big, never went to a dance, never raised my hand, never spoke out loud for the 4 or 5 years I was in high school. It took me 5 years to graduate because I was so emotionally discombobulated. I couldn't pass history, and that's a no-no in New York. You can't get out without that. So I had to do a final year, and that made a pattern for me. I do remember realizing that as a chubby girl, I wasn't going to get, that's what I called myself, chubby, or heavy. I never used the F word. I just don't to this day. It's too painful. Whenever I hear somebody use it, it still pains me. And so what I did was I took amphetamines for a year. When I was 19 or 20, 21, somewhere in there. Lost 45 pounds. Not a whole lot, but it was helpful. And I caught a husband. That's what I wanted. I wanted to catch a husband. When I met him, he was married. That didn't matter to me. He left his wife very soon after we got together. We married 2 years later, and he was abusive. He was an alcoholic, and I didn't know it. So. That didn't turn out the way I thought. See, I was going for the white collar. I came from a bad neighborhood, you know, all rough and tumble type people. So when I got my wits about me, I said, oh, no, I'm only going to work in Manhattan, and I'm only going to date white collar, wingtip shoes. That's what I wanted. So that's why I grabbed the first one that came along that looked very, very possible. And I did. But you know what they say, when you marry for money, you earn every cent. And I did. So anyway, what happened was I had two children that I didn't want. I knew I was not skilled. I knew I had no skill set in that area, but I got more or less bullied into them. But I had two children, and as the marriage progressed, I realized I had to leave, but I couldn't leave because by that time I was at my top weight. And my weight really affected me. I couldn't move from a chair to a sofa. It was quite uncomfortable. So I knew something would have to be done. But when I came into OA, they read the big book at my first meeting. In fact, up north, that's what they use predominantly, is the big book. I got abstinent outside of Chicago in Rockford, Illinois. And when I came into the meeting, the ladies were lovely. There was like three other ladies, possibly four. And there was the big book. I didn't necessarily hear the word abstinence, so I just stayed around waiting for the solution, because I didn't quite realize what the solution might be. But then a flyer came by that there was going to be a workshop, a conference in Chicago, and Roseanne, the founder of OA, was going to be there. And that was in like 85, 86, somewhere around there. And I went. Nobody wanted to go with me. I drove myself. It was like from here to Phoenix. And when I got to the hotel, they had a list of what the meetings were and when Roseanne was speaking. And the first thing I saw was 100-pound weight loss. 100-pounders, they call them. And I thought, that's the room I want. I'm going to that room. And I went to that room, and I stayed in there for hours because I was just waiting for Roseanne to speak. And that's where I heard about the abstinence at that time that was pitched by these 100-pounders was three meals a day, nothing in between, no sugar. That was the 301 plan. It's still in the Dignity of Choice. And it was written in 1962 by Roseanne because her attitude was, we have to eat and have some period of time during the day where we abstain from eating anything. So I was really excited about that. I didn't get a sponsor in OA because there was nobody abstinent or, an average weight. So I went to my priest and asked him if he knew anybody in AA who would sponsor me. And sure enough, he had had a lady just recently who said, anybody who talks about the 12 steps, just refer them to me. So I called that sponsor on the way back from Chicago and I said, I know what abstinence is. This is what they do. You can lose 100 pounds. You know, I was very excited. But it still took me about another year to get it because I was a grazer. If I was awake, I was eating. And the idea of eating and not eating for a period of time was terrifying. I could do it. You know, I could get abstinent for a week, sometimes for a couple of months, and then something would happen, and I'd get too afraid, and I would binge. Because there's no gray area for me. I'm not a nibbler. There's no gray area. I'm either binging, grazing continuously, or I'm three meals a day and I'm not eating anything in between. And that's what I learned that year, is there's no gray area for me. That's one of the reasons that since 1987, I haven't had so much as an olive in between meals, because I can't. When I go to the grocery store, I don't taste the grapes. If my husband's not with me, I just buy a moderate amount and make him eat them if I don't like them. That's the reason I'm so particular and so adamant about my boundaries, is because that year taught me that, the 2 years, 85 to 87, taught me that I have no gray area, that I'm either abstinent or I'm not. So I'm very grateful. I go back to her and I say, okay, I'm going to do it. And it still took me quite a while. And the first thing that happened was I got really terrified First of all, I realized I was going to have to leave an abusive man. Oh, you know, I hadn't worked in 11 years. I had these two kids. I'm worth $7 an hour. It was really terrifying to think that I could actually get it, you know, get what was going to be necessary. But my ex-husband sued me for custody of my children the last time I had 90 days. And so here I have 90 days again. I get served these papers and I say, okay, Michelle, the jig is up. You're in the Midwest, you've got a psychiatric history. I'd already been to four therapists, very expensive. Johns Hopkins Psychiatric Clinic for 2 years. I mean, really good therapy. And I thought, you know, and he knows all this. I really thought it was going to be a long shot that I could get custody of my children in the Midwest. So I stayed abstinent from that minute on, because I thought, these kids need somebody and I'm it. I didn't want to be it, but I had to be it. So in a way, these children that I didn't want actually saved me, because when I got sued for custody, I thought, no way. No way they're going to get my kids. And I stayed abstinent from that 90 days until now. And I'm very grateful that I did, because when I went to court, he asked me why I let my child stay out of school for like 24 days in 1 year. I told him the truth. You know, when you're in the program, you tell the truth and you think the truth has to, you know, fly. And it did. He believed me. He believed me. I was on the stand for 6 hours. And he believed everything I said. Because I was abstinent already, it took 22 months, so I was about 20 months abstinent by that time. And it was very difficult to be abstinent. I say that I stayed abstinent flat on my back, barely breathing, because that's what it felt like. I got fired twice because my nerves got bad. You take that kind of volume food away from me, and I can hardly function. But I'm very glad that I hung in there, because I won the court case. He didn't have any grounds, but you know, he had a lot of money and he knew I didn't. So I did go bankrupt, but I did win the case, and I'm very grateful for that. My boys saw me fight for them, and they know it to this day. Okay. One of the things I really like in our invitation for you is the reasons for the illness are unimportant. I believe that, because the reasons I started to compulsively overeat, the reasons why I self-abused with food for many years, are unimportant when the time came for me to be abstinent and do the real deal, you know, not eat in between no matter what happens. The reasons don't matter at all, because I'd been living on the reasons for a long time. Oh, I got plenty of reasons, you know, if you had my life. He'd be taking comfort in sheet cakes, too. So I'm very grateful for that. I believe it. And the other thing I really like is we have a proven workable method by which we can arrest this illness. And I understand that as the food plan and the abstinence. My food plan and the abstinence just happen to be the same thing. My food plan is 3 meals a day. My abstinence is 3 meals a day. But that's a proven workable method. And those phrases were so comforting to me. There's the solution. There's a real, honest, nuts and bolts thing to do. And I'm very grateful for that. Okay, what it's like now? Well, I divorced that abusive man when I had about 2 years. 2 years for the court case to go through. I took 2 years out. By this time, I'd been on my own for, maybe 6 years, because he'd moved out. And because of my trauma background, I'm a pretty odd fit, as you can imagine. But I was, once I had lost the weight, it took me a year to lose 60 and the second year 40. So I originally had lost 100 pounds, but since my 60s, I've gained that 10 pounds back. I got married at 4 years abstinence. We're still married 27 years later, having fun. He's a little bit of an odd duck, but so am I. So, you know, it works. I've worked all the The tools of the program that I work the most are the telephone, meetings, and sponsorship. The vast 90% of my service is in sponsoring. I don't have the skills for intergroup. I don't have the skills for region. I do chair meetings, but 90%, 95% of my service has always been in sponsoring. And the promises have all come true for me. I love the one, your whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Oh, wow, was that. I had a different set of notes that I left at home. But I was going to go through the promises one by one, but that one is my favorite. Financial insecurity will leave us. It took me quite a while, but pretty soon I was making $8, and then pretty soon I was making $9. $12, I haven't been a big earner. I haven't had a big life. But I've had, thanks to the program and abstinence, I've had all the promises in spades. And I've had a very serene life. I have a relationship with my children, which I never would have had, because when I'm binging, I have that psychic change. I have a tongue like a cat of nine tails. And even my ex-husband used to say he was afraid of me verbally, because I would just, you know, be an attack dog. So I'm very grateful that I stayed in OA, because immediately I knew this is my place, this is my solution, this is the only thing that has any chance of me making a real life, even mentally. Because when I had my first year or two of abstinence, I realized how much more sane I was, because all my life I had been not so much. And I guess that's all I want to say, except I like to keep coming back. I like you will know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. But one of the biggest things is, even though I am not a large person, I don't have a large life, I have a very serene life. And here's the most wonderful thing. I was a scaredy cat all my life, and now I'm not. I came to Tucson without a job, just the two of us. I couldn't take the temperatures up there anymore. We moved to Tucson, neither of us had a job. We just said, we'll go to DES, we'll get jobs. We're $8 an hour, we can live in Tucson, because I live in a mobile home park, a senior mobile home park. So I don't have a large life, but I feel very not afraid. And you know, when you're afraid all your life and you're not afraid, and I've not been afraid for a very long time, I've not carried those 90 pounds for a very long time, I might not be alive, or I'd be a semi-invalid, you know. So I'm just really grateful to be here, and I'm grateful there's OA in Tucson. And I'll pass. Yeah, bring it on.
Let's see, where did the format go? The format.
Anyway, now is the time for questions. And I guess, like they do on the podcast, I repeat them into the mic. Anyone have any questions?
What's a non-doc? What makes somebody a non-doc?
Well, you know, I can see how conventional people live. I know there's a lot of normies. People don't believe there's normal people, but I do.
Could you repeat the question?
Okay, oh, I'm sorry. What makes an odd duck? What makes an odd duck? Even as a child, I could see that there were intact families and people went to the beach together, you know what I mean? And I'm not so much. I always like to pass for normal. Honey, this is normal looking. But
you look normal.
You bet. You bet.
Could you share a little bit about your fifth step?
Of course, I was terrified of the fifth step. I actually took it holding a pillow in front of my face. I could not face the person I was giving my fifth step to, because I had never told my therapist the whole truth and nothing but the truth. But I believed in the program from day one for some reason. And I knew that I was going to take the fifth step, whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help me God. And I cried, but I got it out. And I didn't have the immediate relief because I had so much shame, I was doubled over. But it did make me feel like, okay, I'm going to do this. It was the first thing I'd ever done, totally, because I was a sprinter. I would do something a little bit, and if it didn't tickle me just the right way, I was out of there. But I was determined to work the steps exactly the way they're laid out, because I knew people got sober and stayed sober, and their lives changed. So that's what I wanted. I had never been ambitious before, but when I came into the program, I was ambitious for recovery. And so the fifth step was terrifying, but once it's over, you realize I exaggerated, you know. It wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be, but the pillow helped.
Thank you, Michelle, for your share. It was wonderful. Can you speak on your higher power a little bit?
My higher power has most always been the program itself, OA itself, the group itself. Because I never knew my father, I feel very separated from conventional ideas. But I knew right away that in these rooms, people get different. The steps change people. That's obvious, you know. So I always put my faith in the steps itself and in the program itself. And I've had a couple of spiritual crises over the years, but I always put my faith in the steps themselves, and I always work the steps. You know, in the beginning, I would go up and down the steps in my mind thinking, which one do I need for this? Which one do I need for that? And the way I do the third step is I let it go. That's the way I do the third step. I just say, I'm powerless, and I need to let this go because there's nothing, the serenity prayer. But I've not had a specific paragraph concept of a higher power beyond the program itself.
Thank you very much, Michelle. You've spoken today quite a bit about the promises, and you made the statement, I was a scaredy cat all my life and now I'm not. At what point in the program, at what point in the steps, did you finally realize that fear was not ruling your life anymore?
One of the things that happened when I got abstinent was...
Repeat the question,
please. Oh, I'm sorry. How have the promises come true for me in the area of fear? In order to be abstinent, I had to say where I would eat and where I wouldn't eat, and what I would eat and what I wouldn't eat. Even if somebody baked something for me, I would have to stand for Michelle. I would have to be true to myself and say, you know, in the past I might have let other people determine what I was having or where I was going to eat. So right from the get-go, I knew that I couldn't take any slippery slope when it came to my boundaries, and that there were certain places that just didn't suit me, because all my food had to be top drawer. If it wasn't 8, 9, or 10, somebody else was going to eat it. And if I got stuck with a 4, I would send it back and order something else. So in that way, I grew into myself and said, I can say no over here, and I can say no over there, and I can try to go here. And of course, OA has things that exposes you to things, conferences, and you go places, and you do things, you talk in a microphone. And little by little, I just felt more solid in myself. But I think the abstinence really was the foundation for me, because there was absolutely no wiggle room for me, you know, and it really helped.
Any more questions? Okay.
So we have time for some positive pitches. So for the next 7-8 minutes, we'll open the podium to 3-minute positive pitches. So would anyone like to share? Come up.
Oh, are you kidding?
Go ahead.
I don't like doing this. I didn't like it in the Boy Scouts when I had to give up for my kids.
You don't have to introduce yourself because we're being recorded.
Okay.
Or you can.
I did enjoy the speaker, her honesty. She's very well grounded in her steps. She knows about her boundaries. Now I know why I don't go out to eat any place, because I trust nobody except, I even bought my own food and weighed, measured it last night. It's good to know that somebody has strong convictions on their abstinence. And I've been abstinent a long time. And I'm closer to her age than most people. And I think she's a pretty terrific person. So that odd duck, you're just a special person to me. Thank you for letting me share.
Anybody else? All right, so if that is all, then we will close the meeting. This is an open event, open to the public, so as not to scare people off, we will not, oh, I guess we are going to say the Serenity Prayer. So will all those who care to please join us in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and wisdom to know the difference.